The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Bratvold, and Judge Gaitis, the Honorable Peter Reyes presiding.
Good morning, everybody. Today is October 15th, 2020. We have six cases on our calendar today. This is our third of three oral arguments for this calendar. Before we get started, I just want to check and make sure that everybody can be heard. Let's see, attorney for appellant, can you unmute and just make sure we can hear you? We can see you fine.
Yes, Your Honor. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you. Attorney for respondent.
Yes, Your Honor. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can. Okay. Great. Sounds good. Hopefully we won't have any technical difficulties, but as you know, you never know what can happen. If for some reason we do and somebody is speaking and the clock is going, we will certainly stop it to make sure that we readjust. If there are issues, for example, Mr. Hawkins, I understand that you had to log in, log out. If you have to do that again, we will certainly stop the proceedings so that you can do that. As noted earlier, if for some reason we're having difficulty hearing you, it might be better for you to just stop the video. As of now, it seems like it's working okay, but we will let you know. I will let you know if we run into any issues at all. Obviously, if you're not talking, please keep your microphone on mute. But otherwise, if you are talking, make sure, or getting ready to talk, make sure you turn it off. So this matter that we have, this third matter is case number A19-2035, Mitchell Lay Doc Ho versus State of Minnesota. Attorney for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, and then the state will have 15 minutes for theirs, and Mr. Hawkins, then you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. When you begin, please state your name for the record and the party you're representing. And with that, Mr. Hawkins, you may proceed.
If it pleases honorable court, my name is Charles Hawkins. I represent the appellant, Mitchell Lee Doc Ho. In 1932, the Scottsboro Boys case reached the United States Supreme Court in Powell versus Alabama. In addressing the Sixth Amendment right to assistance of counsel, Justice Sutherland wrote, "A defendant, I quote, requires the guiding hand of counsel at every step of the proceedings against him. Without it, though he be not guilty, he faces the danger of conviction because he does not know how to establish his innocence." Here, Mr. Ho did not have a guiding hand to help him through the legal maze of the charges against him. A guiding hand must have an understanding of both the applicable law and the facts. Mr. Ho's counsel lacked that necessary understanding and was ineffective. Constitutionally ineffective because counsel's conduct or performance fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, and there is a reasonable probability that but for counsel's unprofessional errors, the result of the proceedings would be different. In the context of challenges to guilty pleas based on ineffective assistance of counsel, the second prong, or prejudice prong, is satisfied if the defendant shows that there is a reasonable probability that but for counsel's errors, he would not have pleaded guilty and insisted on going to trial. In evaluating counsel's performance, Mr. Ho must show counsel's representation fell below an objective standard of reasonableness. In Ellis v. Strong, this court found that counsel's failure to properly inform her client of the law may amount to objectively unreasonable performance. The court went on, however, and found where counsel provides affirmative misadvice regarding the law, and where the statutory language at issue is succinct, clear, and explicit, counsel's performance is objectively unreasonable.
Mr. Hawkins, I just want to ask a question. So I don't think anybody here disagrees that defense counsel gave your client incorrect advice with regard to whether a consent offense was available for the charge involving the juvenile. But I am hoping that you can explain for us why the subsequent discussion that she had with Mr. Ho and the offer that she made at that time to move to withdraw the plea didn't cure any ineffectiveness that that may have occurred.
The trial court, or the post-conviction court, I should say, bifurcated the analysis, which we say was inappropriate, because what happened is clearly he was inappropriately and ineffectively advised the consent was not a defense. It was a defense. When she learned about it based upon her client telling her that it was a defense, even though at the plea she used the words non-consensual, which would tell any lawyer that consent is a defense, she immediately turned to talking about the fact that he was facing the potential of a mandatory or a permissive life sentence. The first time that occurs.
So is it your argument that in curing the first incidence of ineffectiveness, the attorney committed a second incidence of ineffectiveness?
Yes.
Okay. Not only. Can I just ask a question with regard to the second incidence? So what if she had not advised Mr. Ho of the possibility, albeit very remote, of a life sentence, and he had received a life sentence? Would your argument still be that she was ineffective?
How could he couldn't have gotten a life sentence?
Well, he could have if he had been indicted following two pleas.
But here in the respondent's brief at page 18, it talks about the sentencing advice. And they state an attorney provides, and this is out of Ellis Strong, an attorney provides her client with reasonable assistance when she accurately informs them of possible direct outcomes of their pleas. If we look at the procedural posture of this case, it was impossible for Mr. Ho to be sentenced to life. We talked about the fact that in order to be sentenced to life, you have to be indicted. In order to be sentenced to life, you have to have priors that fit. The judge talks about it on page 9 and 10 of her order. You have to fit all these requirements. At the present time, and we talked about this, and the response by counsel was, we weren't at that juncture yet in talking about joinder. One of the things she talked about was this concern about there being Spriegel because there were three cases and they'd bring in the other two. Well, one of the ways to avoid the problem with Spriegel is to join the cases under Rule 1703 or 1701 subdivision 4 and try the cases together. That removes your potential of any indictment. It removes the potential of Spriegel. It puts you in a position.
But Mr. Hawkins, you're not alleging that she was ineffective for failing to join the offenses, are you? I mean, your argument here is focused on two incidences, one being the advice given about consent and two being the advice given about sentencing.
Right. But if you put the sentencing over here, in context of joining the offenses for trial, life sentences were off the table. They would never have been able to possibly get a life sentence. The maximum potential sentence they could have got was 45 years on consecutive sentences that he was charged with. It's an ability, the way it was charged at the time that this advice was given, for him to be looking at life. When you look at the email of July 11th of Ms. Campoli, I quote, "The dangerous zone comes upon conviction of a third case where the court could sentence to life in prison. Not if you were indicted, not in the future, but speaking about this case." And then Ms. Campoli, during the post-conviction hearing, admitted on page 31 of her testimony that she misunderstood the punishment provisions that he was charged under. That complicated the initial misadvice and the second advice into affirmative misadvice as well. The lack of telling him that he needed to be indicted to be in there was an omission. But the fact that she told him in writing that if he was convicted on the third case, the court could sentence him to life in prison is just a misstatement of the law, particularly.
Mr. Hawkins, is it really a misstatement of the law? I mean, first of all, I know that she never said that you will face life in prison. It was framed as a possibility. And doesn't an attorney have an obligation to let the client know of all the possible outcomes, regardless of how remote they may be? But second, you talk about that there was no indictment. There's no indictment, but that doesn't mean that the state couldn't come back and do that. And third, when you look at the conditions that have to be met in terms of having two prior sex offenses, they must involve at least three separate victims. And if there's an aggravating factor, we had a juvenile involved here, which potentially could have been argued to be an aggravating factor. Now, doesn't that seem to indicate that there is at least a possibility, it may be remote, but at least a possibility that he could potentially face a life sentence for all of these incidents in which he was involved and he admitted to?
If we take your scenario and if we hypothetically say there's the potential that if he had been indicted, he could be facing a life sentence, the answer is yes. But in the context of this case, in the context of what was happening at the time, what we have on July 12th in this email is a statement by Mr. Ho's lawyer that says he's charged with three separate cases. Those are the current charges. All presumptive felonies, all presumptive commitments, or all felonies, all presumptives. You've got a little discussion regarding the guidelines.
And Mr. Hawkins, there was a fourth one that hadn't been charged yet as well. That...
Yes, there is.
Okay.
And that's referred to. But she's not talking to him about the future. She's talking to him about the three cases that he is charged with. She is talking to him about on these three cases, and you're convicted on a third, the court could sentence you to life. It goes on. Whether the court sentences consecutively, concurrently, or to life in prison, or to something under that would be up to the court exclusively after the trials. She is affirmatively misadvising him about his potential exposure on the three cases he's charged with. And we have to look at this in the context of what this young man, who has no experience in the criminal justice system, is thinking when his lawyer tells him that if you go to trial and get convicted of the third offense, the judge can sentence you to life. And that is absolutely inaccurate in the context of the procedural posture of Mr. Ho's cases.
Mr. Hawkins, my question is this a matter of degree of misinformation? We also have a record that says that this attorney predicted that the more realistic possibility would be somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 years. She indicated during the post-conviction proceeding that she didn't emphasize or overemphasize the possibility of life sentence, that was presented as a possibility, but not the even a likely possibility. So are we to consider how much the statements about a life sentence were brought up and to what degree that was impressed upon this defendant? Or is your argument that simply mentioning it, I think three times is what the record shows, is enough to constitute ineffective assistance of counsel?
It is enough in the context of the procedural posture of this case for her to have advised him that if he went to trial on the three cases he was charged with, not that they have to indict him to get him there, not that they have to bring different proceedings. In the cases that he was charged with, he could be looking at life in prison if convicted of the three cases. That is the context.
So one mention of a life sentence is enough. In other words, it isn't a matter of degree.
Yes, because the defendant testified that I believed if I went to trial based upon this, that I was facing life in prison. It's the defendant's belief about what was going to happen to him that makes these statements so wrong and ineffective. There is no information provided to Mr. Ho about what has to happen to expose him to this. What he believes is that if I choose, and this is in the context of withdrawing his plea, immediately there's no conversation about life without parole before his plea. There's no conversation about him pleading guilty before he pleads because he's facing life. The conversation about life comes up when they're talking about withdrawing the plea. And now his lawyer, who has no experience in trying a sexual assault case anywhere, anytime, provides this advice, never tells him she's never tried a sexual assault case, and provides this advice that on the third conviction, the court could sentence concurrently, consecutively, or to life in prison.
Thank you, Mr. Hawkins. Thank you, Mr. Hawkins. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well. Ms. Lawson, you'll have 15 minutes for your arguments.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, my name is Brittany Lawan, and I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota. The state respectfully requests that you affirm the district court's order denying post-conviction relief because appellant has failed to establish ineffective assistance of counsel on either prong of the Strickland test. Going directly to Judge Gaetis's question about whether we consider the number of times that the life sentence was mentioned, context does matter. If this court were to look at Lee versus United States, that deals mainly with prejudice, but that case talks about how you look at the contemporaneous evidence at the time. You look at everything that's going on at the time. So the context matters. You can't just look at the number of times something is mentioned and make a per se rule that if counsel states something and it's taken out of context, that's automatically ineffective assistance. The district court also did an excellent job here on this order, discussing why on page 8, it is unreasonable for courts to expect attorneys never to make mistakes, but in the event mistakes are made, attorneys should properly address their mistakes, inform their clients of the errors, and take steps to remedy them when given the chance. Attorney Campoli conformed to these expectations and tried to remedy the error made, well, according to the wishes of her client. That goes to the consent, which Judge Gaetis, you are correct that we do not dispute that she gave misadvice regarding whether consent was a defense, but she cured that. She had a 2.5 hour meeting with the defendant, as well as with his mother, who he worked with exclusively on these cases, on his defense. And she talked to him. She said, I made a mistake. I'll withdraw as counsel. I can continue as counsel and file an affidavit. I can do whatever you would like me to do so that we can undo this plea if that's what you would like to do. She basically gave him the power to decide what to do next. And he made a choice. He chose to continue. He chose to take the benefit of that plea agreement and to roll the dice and see what sentence he got. He received at most 62 months when you look at the concurrent sentence of count two. If he would have withdrawn his plea, he would have faced all three counts, and the agreement to not charge the fourth count would also be null. So he could have faced four counts. It is absolutely true that it was a remote possibility that he could get a life sentence, but it is possible. And the attorney in this case had a duty to inform her client of the possibility, but as she testified, she told him it was more likely to be about 10 years. And she did a good job negotiating for him. Judge Meyer actually complimented her motion that she filed at sentencing seeking a departure, noting that she had done a very thorough job. And she got a sentence that amounted to 62 months. That's 5 years. She did a job here that most people would be happy with. But instead, the appellant is here wanting a second chance at undoing the sentence because he's not happy with it. That's not how this works. If this court were to grant post-conviction relief here and say, you know, you had a chance to withdraw your plea. You chose not to, didn't get a sentence you like, but we'll give you another chance. What happens to finality in that instance? This is an instance where counsel made a mistake. She cured that mistake. She talked to him about other remote possibilities in the context of the likelihood of what sentence he would face. And then they proceeded forward. His hindsight is not enough to establish ineffective assistance of counsel, especially given the strong standard of review and the presumption of reasonable representation.
So Ms. Lawan, with regard to evaluating the facts in context, so looking at the attorney's advice about the possibility of a life sentence, I think the argument that Mr. Hawkins is making is that that statement was presented to Mr. Ho at a time in which, you know, was critical for him to make a decision about withdrawal based on the first misadvice, and that he didn't have any the additional information that everyone else is recognizing would have explained the possibility of the life sentence. So he was not given complete advice. So would you respond to that, especially under the first Strickland prong? I'd appreciate that.
Yes, Your Honor. And that's correct that he wasn't given a full discussion of it. The emails, I believe it's Exhibit 6, or it's not. It's one of the July 12th email she talks about in there. She's included the sentencing and the potential sentencing and explaining how after two convictions under 609.3455 subdivision 4.3, if you have two convictions and three victims, it's possible. And in this instance, there was a juvenile defendant who was one of the charged cases and was in fact one of the cases to which the appellant pled guilty. The juvenile's vulnerability was mentioned at sentencing and could have been something to lead to an aggravating factor, which could have made this a life sentence. That's a very remote possibility, but that doesn't mean it's not a possibility. He did not have perhaps as thorough of a description as he might have needed, but that would be something where I think we'd be in a different position if he had received the life sentence and was now claiming he was unaware that that was possible. But given the remoteness of it, here counsel did her diligence and did her duty to give him information about it. I think it would be difficult to expect her to go down not a rabbit hole, but to go down the extreme of every single way in which he could get there and to perhaps even scare him. That could be argued. I could see someone arguing that is coercive to make him plead based on that. And I don't think in looking at the context, that's what happened here.
Do you think a defense attorney has an obligation to advise a client about the statutory maximum sentence that an offense carries, even if the possibility of actually receiving the statutory maximum sentence is remote? And is this any different?
Your Honor, I think that the attorney needs to make sure the defendant's aware of that and to put it in context, even if it is remote. I know that that's also on the charging language. It's usually included on any complaint with, it'll say count one, and it would say maximum 15 years. It's also on a plea petition where it will be included, where the maximum sentence is usually written in by counsel when discussing it with their client. So I believe it has to be discussed. And an individual needs to know what he or she faces if he or she does not plead guilty, but also if he or she does plead guilty. And here, this may not have been perfect representation, but it was adequate. It did not fall below a level of objectionable reasonableness, and it did not prejudice the appellant here. He was remorseful from the beginning. I think it would be difficult to see and to prove that he would not have accepted a guilty plea in these two cases, but for this advice. As the district court concluded, the life sentence aspect wasn't a but-for for these first two guilty pleas. That came afterward. It might have impacted his decision about whether or not to withdraw his plea, but it impacted it and it wasn't incorrect. He gets a chance to, he gets the choice to decide what he wants to weigh and what he wants to do. And in meeting with his attorney, he said he wanted her to focus on the downward departure memo. They met 2 days after the July 10th meeting, they met again, and he said, focus on that. They were talking about the pre-sentence investigation and he directed her to focus on the sentencing memorandum. So here, this may not have been perfect representation, but that is not the standard. Here, he received adequate representation and there is no prejudice that can be established.
Ms. Lawan, I have a couple of questions. It really goes to more the manifest injustice standard and in particular, the intelligence prong. Would you agree that his initial plea was not intelligent?
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't agree that it was not intelligent. I would...
Well, but he didn't know about the consent defense.
He did not know that it was a potential defense, but I would not say that that makes it per se unintelligent. I think that it's cured by the information that he later finds out. So
well,
it's...
That, but that's different. I think we need to break it apart, tease it out temporally. When he entered his initial guilty plea, he did not know about the consent defense.
I agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay. And so because of that, how could that plea be intelligent then?
I'm not aware that you have to have a litany of every single potential defense that you have to a case in order to make a plea intelligent. You could raise a self-defense. You don't have to sign off and say you don't have self-defense. That's often discussed in the plea colloquy. But I don't think that it's a matter of if he doesn't know of this defense, it's automatically involuntary.
Sorry to interrupt, but part of the charge is that it was non-consensual.
Yes. So then in hearing that, as Mr. Hawkins mentioned, one could infer that consent was a defense. Obviously, he had been wrongly informed that it was not. I don't believe it's necessarily involuntary, but even if it were to be involuntary, it's cured. It's okay. Cured and had the, I don't mean to interrupt.
No. And just let's just assume for the sake of argument that it was not intelligent at the time that he pleaded guilty. And I the way I read the district court, I think the district court took that position as well, but then the district court said that initially unintelligent plea had been sanitized by the defendant later learning of the correct information and agreeing to move forward with sentencing.
And I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay. So here's my question, and here's what I'm struggling with, quite frankly, Ms. Lawan, is what authority supports the interpretation or approach that being subsequently informed sanitizes the initial unintelligent plea? Can you cite to any case law? Can you cite to anything at all to support that proposition?
I can't offhand. I guarantee you I'm going to look this afternoon to see. And if I find anything, I'll send a letter of supplemental authority. But I do think that this is an instance where, but for the post-conviction hearing where we get testimony and we got the evidence in which it's made clear what happened and that there was misadvice and then it was cured, we would not have known that because it's not even put on the record here. This might have been an instance where perhaps counsel could have clarified it by putting on the record. At one point, I had told him there was no consent defense. I have since informed him of that, and he says that he does not want to withdraw his plea. That would make a much nicer record, and I'd be happy to be defending it with that statement here. However, I don't have that. I will look and see if there's any case law that would sanitize that, because I understand the question, absolutely. But I'm not aware of any at this moment, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Unless the court has further questions, I would respectfully rely on my brief as well as the order from Judge Meyer and ask that this court affirm the post-conviction petition. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lewan. Mr. Hawkins, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I agree that you have to look at this in context, and how contextually you have to look at it is that on the 10th of July, Mr. Ho told his counsel that she had misadvised him about consent. 2 days later, including during their meeting, she starts talking to him about being exposed to life in prison on the charges that he is currently facing. Although that is not correct, because the statutory maximum on each offense, as correctly pointed out by counsel for respondent, was 15 years, and on the uncharged, it was 10. Now, the context of this whole thing, which goes directly to your point as well, Judge, is that when you put it in context, you have a guilty plea that is not intelligent. It then is being talked about whether we withdraw the plea. And that unintelligent plea is persisted in because of misadvice that if he continues to proceed in the cases that he's in, he's looking at life in prison. And that clearly is set out in the July 12th email.
Right, Mr. Hawkins, now, like you said, though, we need to look at it in context. And while I understand your argument with respect to the life sentence, possible life sentence, that wasn't the only thing that had been discussed. And in fact, as Judge Gaitas mentioned, she told him that he was likely facing 10 years in prison. So based on the guidelines, based on all the information on hand. So that, when you look at the context, it's hard to see how that statement regarding life imprisonment was inappropriate. It's similar, I think, to letting the client know that we can seek downward departures. The state could seek maximum. Here's the maximum you could face. I'm looking at context. I'm struggling as to why that alone.
Because the court's looking at it from the context of the lawyer's conduct and not from the impact it had on the defendant, which is what Lee out of the United States Supreme Court says you look at. It's what the defendant is perceiving based upon the misadvice that we look at, not the context of what the lawyer is doing, but what perception the defendant has. And as the defendant testified on multiple occasions during the course of that hearing, he thought he was looking not at the possibility of life, he thought he was looking at mandatory life. And at the sentencing of Mr. Ho on page 16, in addressing the court in his allocution, he says to the court, which doesn't even cause a pause in the proceedings, "I believe my actions were consensual at the time." He told the court, his lawyer, the prosecutor, and everybody else in that courtroom that he was innocent, and it didn't even get a pause. He persisted in his plea of guilty because, as he testified, "I believed I was going to get a life sentence if I got convicted on these three cases. Not if I was indicted, but on the charges that I was facing, and that's why he persisted. I leave you with this. We're asking you to reverse the conviction or reverse the court's post-conviction order because he was entitled to fair guidance, as Justice Sutherland said. He just didn't get it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments and your briefing. We appreciate it. We will be issuing an order within the statutory timeframe. We wish you both well, and please stay safe.
As we wish the court.